Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard across the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the show, Jason Chaffetz reinvents himself as a Fox News political pundit. Republican Senate leaders postpone a vote on their health care bill, and while the Brian Head fire rages on, environmentalists and state legislators disagree on what's fueling fires in the West. Those stories and others on the program today. Joining us for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune Managing Editor David Noyce. Welcome, David.
Good morning.
Public Lands reporter Brian Maffley is here with us as well. Welcome, Brian.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Thanks very much. Also on the phone from the nation's capital, we've got Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr on the line. Tommy, are you there?
I'm here. Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome. Thanks for being here. And also Tribune columnist Robert Gerke is here in studio with us. Good morning, Robert, and welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
We also want to hear your thoughts during this Friday morning news wrap-up. Weigh in on the stories that we are covering today with your questions and comments. You can post them at sltrib.com or at the KCPW Facebook page, or you can call us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. And let's start with Brian Maffley and the wildfire in southern Utah, the Brian Head Fire. It's closing in on 60,000 acres consumed. It's a fire that has done a lot of destruction. There are something like 1,700 firefighters trying to combat it, and the wind and the heat have not helped. Still the biggest fire in the country, I think. You wrote about this earlier this week, but not in the context of what's happening there on the ground, but because of some comments on the periphery.
Yeah.
And maybe I'll just let you tell us this story. This is about what causes the intensity of
the fires.
Western wildfires.
Well, so put this into context, this will be one of the largest, expensive, costliest fires since the 2008 Milford Flat fire. So this was, if you're going to call a fire catastrophic, this is probably fits that bill. And it's spurred a great deal of anger among rural county commissioners and lawmakers who feel that if only we could log and graze the Dixie National Forest as much as we would like, fires like these wouldn't happen. And the logic being that if you log the Dixie National Forest, it won't burn because the wood will be gone. That's a pretty simplistic notion, and it's not borne by science. So Representative Mike Noel, one of our most visible anti-environmentalist lawmakers, took this opportunity to take a lot of what would seem to be cheap shots at several environmental groups, including one that we don't think exists anymore, the Friends of Dixie National Forest.
Yeah. And he also made some comments about who's kind of in charge at the Forest Service, right?
Yeah, so the comment he made, it was at a press event at Brian Head a couple days ago, where he said, these type of disasters are what happens when you turn the Forest Service over to what he called bird and bunny lovers. Tree huggers, we're all familiar with that term. And then rock lickers was the one that people got a big laugh out of.
Right.
And in hindsight, we all kind of assumed he was talking about environmentalists because he mentioned a few environmental groups. But when Pat Bagley, the cartoonist, and I were talking about it the next day, we thought rock lickers is actually a funny term for geologists. Because when you lick a rock, you can learn about its makeup and the geology from putting moisture on it. And I'm beginning to wonder now if Mike Noel was actually talking about having scientists develop policy and run these agencies now, the agencies being the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service. But then he goes on and mentions the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, probably, that sounds like a rock-licking organization,
right.
And Grand Canyon Trust.
Well, and you mentioned these environmental groups like those two that you've just mentioned and others that are maybe now defunct. But what he's saying they're doing is preventing logging from occurring on forest land. That's not something that's actually happening. Is that correct?
Well, there is. Okay, he was going back 25 years to the early days of a bark beetle outbreak on the Markagunt Plateau. And since then, this bark beetle epidemic has spread throughout the West into Canada. It's affecting millions and millions of acres, including 2 million acres in Utah. And so the logic, the thought was, is, well, if we were doing logging these beetle kill spruce up there, the forest wouldn't be in the perilous condition it is in now. The fact is that logging has occurred to a limited extent up there. There is a lot of dead timber up there that may not be what's driving this fire. It might be the younger trees that have grown up between the dead trees. The trees have been dead for so long, all their fine fuels have broken off and have fallen to the ground and probably have decomposed into the soils by now.
The fact that part of the sort of thinking behind why this fire is as intense as it is because of the amount of fire suppression that's happened over the years. Is that correct?
Actually, I think this fire was so intense because of the weather. We're in day 14 of this fire. Half of those days were what we call red flag days, when the conditions are so hot, dry, and windy that they're deemed to be highly dangerous fire conditions. And so when you look at how that fire developed, day one in Bryan, right on the edge of the town of Bryanhead, for the first 3 days, it burned on land administered by the state of Utah, not the National Forest. It's very dense, small trees. There's a lot of dead stuff in there. My wife and I were skiing up there for, Nordic skiing for spring break, and you could see how, the forest really is in bad condition. There's no question.
And this is and this is maybe partially because of pine bark beetle infestation. Is that, the bad shape you're talking about, is that hard to say?
Well, I don't know. Why that fire? We have bark beetle, we have climate change, we have passed a whole history of excluding fire from the forest. And frankly, bad logging practices from our grandparents' era. Logging's changed quite a bit. And it's not nearly as profitable because the Forest Service doesn't want to take out as many old-growth trees. So those are the trees that are both the most valuable, those big ponderosa that are 100, 200 feet high with huge trunks. But they're also the most ecologically valuable. And those trees need to remain behind if you want to have a healthy forest that's fire-resistant. Remember, fires and forests have been going together for millions of years before people were here.
I want to remind listeners that they're invited to join this conversation if you are, whether or not, if you're a bird-loving,
rock-licker,
tree-hugging, bunny-loving rock-licker, give us a call. 801-355-8255 is the number to call, or you can go to sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page and post your comments. Selective logging, though, Bryan, is that being prevented under the people currently in charge at Forest Service or wherever this fire happens to be occurring?
Well, it's not being prevented, but it's definitely not happening at the pace that the Garfield County Commission, for example, would like to see. There are for the last 10 years, as long as I've been on this beat and before, the projects have been highly geared toward thinning. Prescribed burning. They're going into the shingle burn area down by Duck Creek, for example, pulling out some of the burned logs. But those, when you look at how these timber sales are harvested, they're really not even timber sales. They're what we call stewardship contracts, where the Forest Service is basically hiring an operator to clean up the forest. And they're not going to make money on the wood they're harvesting. And another problem for Utah is that might be slowing these projects down is we don't have mills anymore to process these logs. And so Panguitch had a big lumber mill that closed in the mid-90s, the Kaibab Industries. At its heyday, it probably employed 400 people back in the 80s. But that 80s was a time when the Forest Service was subsidizing logging. It was kind of anything goes. Things have changed radically since then.
In terms of economics and so on. I'm wondering if you're any good Boy Scout or Girl Scout knows that that fire is a natural process and that, long term it can be good for a forest. Is this fire that's happening now long term going to be helpful in a way, Bryan?
Yeah, that's probably something I'll be doing a story on next week, I hope. We don't know. When fires are kind of this destructive, like we saw this at the Seeley Fire in 2012 down in Emory County, they can do a lot of damage to the watershed. They cook the soils, then they become what they call hydrophobic. The water just careens off of it when next time you have a monsoon rain event, and it takes down all sorts of soil, clogs up the creeks, kills the fish. That's not a positive thing at all. In the long term, we'll see. I always like to look, whenever I go up to Montana, you drive through what burned in the Yellowstone fires, and those were very destructive. But then the forest is coming back. It's a beautiful thing to behold. Mm-hmm. Maybe in 30 years we'll see something like this up by Bryanhead.
You know, I want to bring Robert Gerke, who is the Salt Lake Tribune columnist, and he can express an opinion here. Politics. The blame game kind of happens here as well. Fires happen. I don't know, Robert. Yeah. What's your comment on pointing a finger at environmentalists?
Well, I mean, every year we have fires, and every year we have politicians blaming environmentalists for causing the fires. And you know, Brian kind of touched on it, but I think the science on this is pretty clear that what we're seeing, we are seeing the fire seasons getting longer. We're seeing the intensity of the fires getting worse. The large fires have increased by over 50% over the last couple decades. But the cause of that, is scientists believe, is climate change. And we're living in a world where it's getting hotter, where our burn season's getting longer, the forests are getting drier, the dry, hot forests make it so the trees can't resist these bark beetles that come in and just devastate leave these dead trees standing there. And you know, that's something that Mike Noel isn't going to be talking about, because, you know, it's more inconvenient than trying to blame and point the finger at environmentalists. We should note that the environmental group that he blamed for this blocking this Tippett sale lost their challenge to that sale, and the sale could have gone forward, but those trees were never harvested. So there's some inconsistency, I guess, between the facts and Mike Noel's version of events there as well. But, you know, it's not a simple thing. And what do we do about it? If the climate's going to keep changing, we're going to keep seeing it getting worse and worse over the coming years. And we need better solutions. We don't need people pointing fingers, and we don't need Mike Noel running around in, you know, these with his pants on fire and in these tinder dry conditions.
You know, I seem to remember a couple of years back, maybe 3 or 4 years now, that then Representative Craig Powell was trying to get legislation passed at the legislature to give fire managers sort of authorization to consider climate change or to factor in climate change as they make plans for the future. I don't think that passed. Does anybody have any recollection of this?
I don't know that, Bill Rogers.
They didn't pass it. And to not consider it is just to be, you know, putting your head in the ground. And it's just, it is a fact. And they need to wake up to this because, yeah, it's going to keep getting worse, and we're seeing the results of it already.
Yeah. Well, I would add to that, you know, if you don't start looking at the real reasons why the forests are in bad shape, you're going to develop policies that aren't going to fix it. And I sense that that's kind of where we're headed. I mean, the solution that Mike Noel and the rural county commissioners, I think, are looking for is policies that encourage more logging.
Okay. Yeah. Brian, you mentioned the groups that represent that, you know, Noel was unhappy with from the environmental community, among them the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, which is, I think you point out, largely involved in red rock and desert conservation. You reported this week on some terrain that the Bureau of Land Management is opening up to oil and gas leasing that is causing a stir because of its proximity to a couple of scenic desert landscapes. Maybe you can tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, now that we have a new sheriff in town or in the White House, there seems to be a shift in the direction that the BLM is going toward, you know, deciding what lands are going to be leased for oil and gas development to something that's a lot more, excuse the term, liberal, you know. And so some of the places that are going to be made available at an auction in December are around the San Rafael Swell and specifically a place called Moulin Reef with a lot of rock art. We haven't even documented how much is there. And then other areas that are either up against Dinosaur National Monument or within the view shed from the famous quarry site where most of the visitors go.
Hmm. The Moulin Reef area of the San Rafael Swell, this is an area that former BLM managers refused to or wouldn't lease within because of those cultural artifacts.
Exactly. So a few years ago, this then state director Juan Palma, at the last minute, right? I mean, seriously, like 2 days before the auction, withdrew several parcels that were in this general vicinity, specifically because of their rock art resources. And so apparently that logic now no longer applies, and the BLM is going to, right now these are proposed leases. So environmental assessment is underway. A draft was released. A final will be come out in the next couple months that will then essentially lead to the authorization of these leases.
And that authorization happens from the Interior Secretary, from Ryan Zinke himself, or from
the State Director.
From the State Director, okay. Yeah. Because Zinke has talked about past managers, and I'm assuming this might be Juan Palma, thwarting what he called America's energy dominance.
Yeah, you saw that. Yeah. It was op-ed. That was an op-ed in the Washington Times a couple days ago. He co-wrote with EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt and I think the Energy Secretary. And what they were saying was the federal government has gotten in the way of energy development, and that's going to change. And so he's basically signaling that what guided these leasing decisions for the last 8 years under Obama are going to be overhauled. That will allow for more leasing and a ramp up of approvals for drilling projects.
Sort of a campaign promise, visions, differing visions for future planning. When is the auction for these lands planned?
For the ones in the San Rafael Swell and Dinosaur, those are in December. These are quarterly auctions, and then the next auction's in March. And there's a lot of acreage in San Juan County that seems to overlap critical archaeological sites that are now being considered.
Does BLM take public comment on this, or is policy just okay?
Yes, you can. It's a draft EA is out currently on the San Rafael Swell, Dinosaur ones. Public comment is due by the end of July, July 24th.
Well, Robert Gerke, I might as well throw this to you. Also, a change in sort of concept at the Bureau of Land Management.
Yeah, it is a bit of a change. I mean, they've always had an eye toward developing oil and gas, but there have been areas where they've stayed away from, and now it looks like they're being a little more aggressive about going after those. You know, there are still opportunities to stop this, as Brian mentioned. The environmental assessments are still being done on these, and they will be taking a look at them. But, you know, and ultimately, at the end of the day, it kind of depends on whether the market for oil and gas even comes back, I mean, or oil at least, because right now the economics of it have really kind of caused a decline or a depression in Utah's oil economy. And so, we're going to have to see where that goes, too. But you can see, as Brian mentioned, they're pushing up against these boundaries in various places around the state, and it's troubling.
Brian, just last question, and then we have to go to a break. But does the environmental impact assessment, the EA that happens, does that incorporate or include cultural resources?
Yeah, to be fair to the BLM, it does include what's called drilling stipulations that will be attached to these leases that are designed to protect these non-energy resources, namely rock art, archaeological sites, riparian areas. And then, before drilling happens, there's more environmental analysis. So it's not like, they sell the lease and there's a drill rig, on top of a kiva, It's right. And we got to be clear about that. But leasing isn't the act that obligates the federal government to make these lands available and enables energy development in places where not everybody agrees it would be the best place.
Okay. Yeah. Brian Maffley, public lands reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune, many thanks for this and for joining us today. I know you need to get out of here. When we come back, we will turn to the retirement of Jason Chaffetz and the latest on the Republican health care bill. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune Managing Editor David Noyce, Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr, and Tribune columnist Robert Gerke. We're discussing this past week's local news, and we welcome your questions and comments at either sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page, or call us at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Thomas Burr, Washington Bureau Chief. Today is Representative Jason Chaffetz's last day in office. Actually, I think he's done already. He announced back in April that he was retiring. We learned this week that he has a gig waiting for him, and it seems that the rumors were true. Fox News is in the congressman's near future.
You got it. So officially, as of 8 a.m. Utah time, the congressman is no longer a congressman, so he's a former member of Congress. And he's going to start with Fox News officially tomorrow. I don't think he'll actually be on the air tomorrow. I think he said he was going to go on a camping trip or something like that with his family. But starting July 1, starting tomorrow, he'll be a Fox News contributor, which means he'll be one of those, you know, pundits on the shows like Special Report with Bret Baier, you know, talking about the day's news, similar to Newt Gingrich or Sarah Palin, and frees him up pretty much to do say what he'd like to say. He's also talked about a few other things he's going to do. He wants to write a book about the deep state, as conservatives call the federal bureaucracy that they believe tries to sway decisions on their own political leanings. He's going to go on the speaking circuit. He's starting a consulting business to work with companies that want to understand how to work with Washington, not as a lobbying thing, more of as a explanatory role, as he explains it, because he's actually banned from lobbying for 1 year,
right.
And it's doubtful he's actually going to become a lobbyist.
You know, just back to the Fox News part of the story, yep. You know, it doesn't sound like a 9-to-5 gig, you know, occasional appearances as a commentator. Is there a contract associated with that? Do we know how much the congressman's getting paid to do that?
He won't say how much he's getting paid, though he's pretty clear that they took care of him, is how he phrased it. It's a good package, so, you know, you can take your own guesses as to what it is, but it's not minimum wage. And it doesn't come with the housing allowance, it sounds like, but, it's, you know, he's going to get paid enough, he can deal with it. And the gig is, as far as I understand it, because he's not giving us the contract, there's no, like, set amount of hours or anything he has to spend on the network. He just needs to be available for the most part. For when they need him to run up to Salt Lake City or fly into New York or D.C. to appear on a show.
Right. He said wherever you know, cameras are, he can work from there, essentially.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping they'd set up a little studio in his house in Alpine because I think that'd be funny. but it doesn't sound like that's the case.
Okay. Tommy, we're going to circle back around to you in just a second for more on Chaffetz and his legacy and future. But I want to ask columnist Robert Gerke a question here. Is Jason Chaffetz a darling of the right? And I ask this because I think that if you'd asked me a few years ago if Chaffetz was headed for a career as a political pundit, I wouldn't have immediately jumped to that conclusion. But Fox News has kind of anointed him here. So is he a beloved figure?
I mean, he is. Out of the 435 members of Congress, he is one of the people you see most often on these television shows and talking about specifically about the issues that the conservative wing of the party that cares about. He was, you know, frequently talking about Benghazi and the IRS and reforming that and the Secret Service. So he's talked about these issues that came to his plate as chairman of the Oversight Committee, and he's done it frequently. So it's not terribly surprising. He is fairly telegenic in that he is, you know, he gets how the media works. He plays the game. And I think, if he's going to go work at Fox, he maybe needs to dye his hair blonde and start harassing people. But, I think it's going to be a pretty good fit for him, frankly. One of my first encounters with Jason Chaffetz was down at the, when he was running for office the first time, and he gave this just fiery red meat speech at the convention. And it was probably one of the better political speeches I've ever seen, and had just, you know, heaps of bloody red meat that the crowd just loved. And so he can deliver that. And I think that's going to be part of what he's going to be doing.
Well, and Tommy, you mentioned that he's run his own sort of communications firm in the past, meaning he can stay on message or whatever the appropriate terminology is there. This is almost a ridiculously formulaic question, but just to Tommy and also David Noyce, who we haven't heard from yet, what is the congressional legacy of Jason Chaffetz? Is it as sort of an investigator? I think of the Benghazi investigation. What is his legacy? And I don't know who wants to jump in there first. David?
I would guess it's his cot. No, it's not, actually. But although Chaffetz literally became a media star overnight for sleeping on that cot for the past 8 years. Actually, a couple of cots. Tommy wrote about that today. I think it's kind of a mixed bag for Jason Chaffetz. We obviously haven't seen the last of him politically.
Right.
I think people pretty much think he's trying to bankroll some money, getting some coins, so he can re-enter politics. He's obviously expressed interest that possibly running for governor. Congressionally, I don't know that you can point to huge victories, although when he was head of the Oversight Committee, he certainly posted many of victories on that website about people that the committee had targeted and corruption they had found and weeded out. I think it became more conflicted when Trump became president, a little bit more difficult for him the whole investigations of the president sort of seemed to drag his feet a little bit on that. At least the critics certainly think that. And so I think that it became a little kind of politically difficult to navigate that.
There have been people pointing to the idea that had Hillary Clinton won, he would have had a better time as chairman of the House Oversight Committee because he would have had what he called, I think, a field day. Tommy, is that the language he used?
Yeah, in fact, he also said the same thing about Trump, that he'd be a kid in a candy store. I don't think we've seen that necessarily. It is ironic in some point, I think I've said this before, that Chaffetz was the first one to put out the Comey letter in October that certainly cost Hillary some votes and helped Trump in some way get elected. And then it turns out that Trump does get elected, and Chaffetz is now having to investigate a member of his own party. But I'd say if there is a legacy, it's that he was a pain in the rear for Obama and Hillary Clinton these last several years.
Tommy, David Noyce brought this up, a retirement from Congress as of 8 a.m. Mountain Time this morning, but maybe not from government and politics. The Fox News rumors, it turns out, were true. When will we learn whether the run for governor rumor is true?
He's got some time. There's no rush. The election is 2020, so like Dave said, he's going to make some cash. He's more well off than I think all of us. But he's not super rich like some other people. So he'll make some money. Let's remember, actually, when he decided to run for Congress, he announced it before Chris Cannon had even been sworn into his next term. So 2 years out, essentially. So he may do something early just to try to scare the field of people who may run, but there's no rush.
The pattern he's following here in terms of the potential run for governor reminds me a lot of the route John Kasich took. He's the Ohio governor now, but he was a member of Congress, went to work doing a TV show, I think it was the Kasich Report, and then used that as a springboard to run for governor back in Ohio. So there is a path for Jason to kind of follow in that regard. And I think Tommy hit his legacy right on. I think he's sort of been the partisan attack dog on these issues like Fast and Furious, Benghazi, and all of these others that have just really kind of, and he's been effective at it in terms of it did cause inconvenience and it did cause problems for both Obama and the Clinton campaign.
This being having left office as of today, have his colleagues said much about his departure? Has there been a sort of retrospective commentary from fellow Utahns on the Hill, for
example?
Did
they have cake and gold watches for
them? Right, or green Jell-O.
Jell-O. You've got to have the Jell-O. I think there was a pretty good universal, he did a great job and we'll miss him from the Republican side, and even a little bit of that from the Democratic side. Congressman Elijah Cummings, who, almost on the polar opposite of the political spectrum from Chaffetz, was very kind about how he thought he was, treated the Democrats well and listened to their concerns. Even if they didn't always, get their way, he at least would be willing to talk to them. I think there's everyone's pretty happy. I think Senator Orrin Hatch is happy that Chaffetz is not going to run for anything in 2018. And again, this is a guy that we're going to be seeing on TV all the time, so we're not going to be really missing him necessarily.
Tommy, I just have to quickly jump in there for a second on Senator Orrin Hatch. Is he is Senator Hatch absolutely running for an eighth term?
It depends on his mood at the time you ask him. Okay. From what I understand, so I've talked to him and he's not making any formal decisions, and then he'll tell some other news outlet that he's running, and then he'll say, I'm still considering it. He's certainly laying the groundwork. He's raised a ton of money, and he's not ruling it out yet, but who knows?
There's also some benefit, I think, to him keeping us in suspense, because once you announce you're not running, he loses some of his SWAT with his Senate colleagues and possibly with the Trump administration. So maintaining that unknown quality, I think, works to his advantage to some degree.
Withholding some information there. One last question just before we go on to other stories, but why? Just remind us why Chaffetz decided to leave office, Tommy.
He gave a few reasons. The usual politician, I want to spend more time with my family. But he also has been more increasingly frustrated, it sounds like, with his role. Congress really doesn't do regular order anymore and actually, pass budgets and do the things. It's so much more political in this town than when he came. And he was also getting frustrated. He thought when Trump came into office that the administration would be more forthcoming with documents requested by the Oversight Committee. That apparently wasn't the case. He's still waiting on documents from years ago. So I think it's a combination of he's frustrated with the situation. It's an untenable spot to be the Republican oversight chairman investigating the Republican president. And if he wants to move on to, the governor's mansion, he's got to go back to Utah and spend a little more time there.
Lay some groundwork.
Just to jump in, I mean, Tommy mentioned that Jason Chaffetz, the notion that Jason Chaffetz could be frustrated with the partisanship in Congress is kind of, listeners can't see this, but I rolled my eyes so hard they got stuck. He's responsible for the partisanship in Congress because he used that position as House Oversight Chair to go on these witch hunts, to go on these attacks constantly. And so the notion that, I mean, he's part of the problem, not part of the solution. I've never seen Jason Chaffetz, frankly, show bipartisanship in any legitimate substantive way, and so that's kind of nonsense.
Well, lots of people say they're going to Washington as reformers, right?
Yeah.
Guys, I do want to transition to another DC related story, but I thought that we actually might start with the local angle, and this is the vote on the Republican health care bill that was originally scheduled for yesterday and was postponed because of a lack of support for a variety of reasons, and we'll get to that. But Managing Editor David Noyce, I thought we might point to the opposition that happened here on the home front to this GOP proposal. That took a couple of forms. One was a protest, another a petition, and maybe we could start with the protest. This took place on Tuesday, I think?
Yes, I think it was Tuesday.
What happened?
About 150, maybe 200 people assembled at the Bennett Federal Building downtown. To protest the Senate GOP health plan, specifically worrying about cuts to Medicaid down the road that the Congressional Budget Office has documented and how many people will be hurt by it. Many things have happened since the Trump administration came, sort of have people angry. These are the kinds of things that have people scared. They're really afraid about losing their benefits. And the rally stretched out across the street. They specifically targeted our two senators, of course, Orrin Hatch and Mike Lee. Mike Lee, of course, is on record right now as opposing the plan as it's written right now and as it's obviously being redrafted again. So they really went after Senator Hatch. They even blocked traffic on State Street. Had a banner that they said, Senator Hatch, don't kill us. Very strong language, and some exchanges happened with drivers and motorists frustrated, couldn't get through. So,
right. The GOP proposal would phase out Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act, and you mentioned that this is one of the things that the protesters were particularly upset with, Medicaid in particular, the loss of Medicaid. A number of disabled protesters.
Yes. As a matter of fact, a couple wheelchair protesters. And these were people, a lot of people there, personally affected by it, either themselves or their families. As a matter of fact, a couple of people in wheelchairs were blocking traffic and running their wheelchairs into the bumpers of a car and things like that. And so, it got that way. It lasted for about 30 minutes, then it ended. But
separately, there was a petition that was delivered to Senator Hatch's office and maybe Senator Lee's office here in Utah.
I just know for sure Senator Hatch, although I may have given it to him. It was the next day. A coalition of groups, including people from Health Policy Project and a couple of others, a couple Latino groups, immigrant groups also, gathered this petition. And the petition had 5,000 signatures of people urging them, of course, to back away from this plan and preserve benefits and that are planned to kick in and things like that. But it also included 1,000 testimonials, personal stories, of how healthcare coverage that they've achieved, many of them under Obamacare. And they don't want to lose those.
Okay, how it's making a difference in, or what it's doing for their lives. You know, have Senator Hatch or Senator Hatch in particular on this case, because Senator Lee, and we'll get to this, is not on, or wasn't on board with this proposal as it stood. Was there a response from the senator's office?
The spokesman, Matt Whitlock, basically said, first of all, in the first case, they were a little offended, naturally, by the personal call out that the good senator is killing people, saying that they certainly agree with their right to protest, but that message is far beyond the pale, and pointed to many of the things that the senator has done throughout his long career, pointing to the CHIP program, of course, that he helped pass with late Senator Kennedy. And then said, but Senator Hatch is working to bring better health care to people and getting rid of this Obamacare that's been a failure, or okay, will be a failure.
CHIP being the Children's Health Insurance Program. Tommy Burr, I want to bring you back into this. There was a difference of opinion between the two senators on the GOP health care plan. One was for it, as we said, Senator Hatch. One was not, and that was Senator Mike Lee, our other senator. Why the difference of opinion?
Yeah, let's be clear. Senator Lee opposed this because he didn't think it went far enough. He thought it was spent too much money, that it was still kind of Obamacare light in some form. He's not opposing it because he thinks it was... he thinks it would hurt Utahns who need these health care subsidies. He sees a different approach to solving the health care crisis. And he had some friends. So he was one of five senators who were opposed to the bill. And the Senate Republicans just really had a hard time because if they change the bill to try to get Senator Lee and Rand Paul, then they lose Susan Collins and Dean Heller. So they've got this kind of like, if they want the conservatives, they're going to lose the moderates. If they want the moderates, they're going to lose the conservatives. And Republicans only hold 52 seats, so if they lose three, they're done. And that's where we are right now. They had to postpone the vote. They're coming out with another draft, I think, later today, which then the CBO has to score. And so we're really looking into, you know, later in July for this to come back up. And even then, it seems really difficult to get something that they can all support.
Right.
And if
Robert Gerke,
just real quick, I mean, if to kind of piggyback on what Tommy was saying, that from the reporting I've read is that they're looking at trying to reduce some of the coverage cuts and then keep maintaining to do that, or maintaining one of the taxes that the conservatives don't like. And so you can see where they're not going to get the Mike Lee, Ted Cruz people on board with that if they're maintaining this tax and reducing the cuts. So yeah, the Republican leadership has a real problem on their hands right now.
Tommy, just to kind of close this out, is there opposition on the other side of the spectrum from Republicans? I mean, you've got the Mike Lee camp who says this isn't doing enough to undo Obamacare. It's not going far enough. And then, as Robert Gerke points out, they're obviously among them the protesters here in Salt Lake City who probably weren't on the GOP side. But are there Republicans who say this is doing too much, is being too, you know, mean, the way the president might put it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I mentioned both of them, the two that really stand out right now, Susan Collins of Maine and Dean Heller of Nevada. Heller, you know, Nevada is a pretty purple state, and he's worried about the impact, I'm sure, on his constituents and also his reelection if he were to support this. And it's really kind of falling apart to the point where President Trump, gosh, I can't remember if it was yesterday or today, I get his tweets, there's so many of them, he suggested maybe we should just repeal Obamacare and replace it later, which had been an idea out there, because then the Republicans can tell their constituents, yes, we got rid of Obamacare, without actually having to put something in place they can be judged on.
We do have to take a break, but I'm wondering if anybody can answer this. Does the insurance lobby want to see the undoing of Obamacare? I mean, do they stand to benefit more if it remains with its individual mandate to purchase insurance, or if it goes. Anybody have a data there? Maybe not.
Well, a lot of people.
I think Anthem came out with a supportive statement, but some of the other parts of the insurance industry, I think, are concerned, because when you have fewer people on the insurance rolls, then you have fewer people paying in.
And I think I believe the hospitals are in opposed to the repeal version, and I think the medical association is as well.
Guys, we have still more stories to cover on the show. We could talk about this topic for the remainder of it, but I guess just to close this out, is there any sense of when this vote might happen? Tommy, I think you kind of addressed this, but behind the scenes stuff happening now, can we expect a vote at any point in the near future?
July 10, the week of July 10, is when Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, said he would bring this back up. But again, they've got a lot of negotiating that's going to happen. We may never see a vote.
All right, to make it palatable. We'll see where that goes. Right now, though, it's time for another quick break here on the program. We'll be back with a story about dastardly Salt Lake City drivers in just a moment. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's David Noyce, Thomas Burr, and Robert Gerke. We invite you to share your questions, comments, and, thoughts during this Friday morning news roundup by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page. And David Noyce, we were talking during the break about this this study that came out putting drivers in Utah's capital city, in Salt Lake City in particular, among the worst in the nation. It's looking at data points related to accidents, DUIs, citations, and the like. And we're not dead last, but we are close.
It depends on how you want to look at it. We're second, as in the worst.
second to last.
Behind Sacramento. So these studies come out from time to time. Lee Davidson wrote this story. And the studies always, they all look at different data. So it just depends on what they're looking at, also right, as to how they come out and how they're scoring, how they come out. I think one of the studies in there, he says, like, Salt Lake City was like 70th or something like that out of 150 or so.
Depends on how they're crunching the numbers.
Exactly. But I'm sure many drivers here would think, how did we not get first? You know, that's certainly a prize we should have been able to claim.
Well, apparently a heavy weight was given to speeding violations in this. And maybe, you know, I don't want to go overboard with the story here, but I'll ask listeners to call in with their Utah driving pet peeves. And you can call 801-355-8255. But maybe I'll throw that to the group as well. Just to add some qualitative data to the conclusion of this study that Salt Lake City has the worst drivers. Robert Gerke, number one pet peeve for Salt Lake City drivers?
Utah drivers? I was reading this story while I was driving in today, and no, I think it's the texting, seeing people on their phones and not paying attention to the road. It's dangerous, but it's frightening when somebody starts drifting into your lane or is, you know, just completely oblivious to what's going on. I don't mind speeding that much. I mean, I frankly speed a little bit too, and I don't think going a few miles an hour over is the end of the world.
David Noyce?
Well, speeds were highlighted, and of course the state has been raising speed limits. UDOT has studied this, and they insist that people really aren't going that much faster, even those 80-mile-per-hour stretches. Mm-hmm. That's sort of going what the traffic was and could go. Of course, now this is looking at inner-city driving, things like that. But right, even the freeway stretches in Salt Lake City, are the speed limits are higher.
But, David, you have one particular pet peeve when it comes to drivers in Utah.
Well, I don't like driving at all. So
I like it.
So just the fact that people are driving is part of one of my pet peeves. I was able to move downtown, and now I don't drive very much, which is
fantastic.
Made me very
I'll
happy.
Throw one more in there. The people that just either don't use their signal or they just drive all the way down the street with their signal on and don't ever move. It's aggravating.
It used to be called the eventual left.
I want to get Thomas Burr, Tommy, you don't live here, but that actually might give you a kind of unique perspective. What's your Utah driving pet peeve?
Yeah, I think it's people texting and not paying attention whatsoever. It's a little scary when I come back. But then again, I haven't owned a car in 10 years, and I, you know, live in a metro area where I can take public transit pretty easily. So yeah,
I can't believe nobody's brought up people staying in the passing lane, in the left lane, the fast lane, and not moving out of that lane.
That's my wife's. Yes. So yeah.
All right. Well, guys, that was fun.
Shade.
Throwing shade. You know, before we go, because we do have to turn to our underplayed stories of the week here shortly, I'd like to actually spotlight a column for a moment. And this is Robert Gerke, something that you wrote about earlier this week, about what it takes in this day and age to do journalism. This was a piece that you wrote that features John Oliver, host of HBO's Last Week Tonight. Mm. And it's because you and he have something in common. Actually, I should say that the Salt Lake Tribune and John Oliver have something in common. And it's that you've both been sued by the same man. Tell us the story.
Well, he didn't actually sue us, but okay. Bob Murray threatened repeatedly. We're coming up on the 10th anniversary of the collapse of the Crandall Canyon coal mine. It was in August of 2007. And during our reporting on that, we got threats of lawsuits several times. And then, Bob Murray... We were reporting that this coal mine collapsed because it had an unsafe mine plan that they didn't exactly follow. They didn't report problems at the mine in a timely fashion, and we also did some reporting on sort of how mercurial, I guess, or bombastic Bob Murray was. He was eventually banned from briefing the family members because he was abusive and made children cry during the briefings. They didn't like the reporting on that, and they threatened repeatedly to sue us if we didn't stop. We didn't stop, and ultimately all the investigations into that collapse ended up validating everything that we had reported. So John Oliver last week, did a piece on the situation, the decline in coal, and sort of pointed out that it was not necessarily environmentalists and the Obama administration that was killing it. It was the it was just competition from natural gas and renewable energy. And then he kind of went off on Bob Murray in a pretty hilarious way, and it's worth watching. I think it's pretty great. But the next day, Murray Energy sued John Oliver over that, and I just, you know, in my take on it was that, you know, we need people who are willing to stand up and not be threatened, you know, not be intimidated by these threats of lawsuits. That and Bob Murray, for the, you know, he's sued the New York Times, he's sued Huffington Post, he's sued just a string of newspapers. There's two in Ohio, there's one in West Virginia he's sued the United Mine Workers, he's sued this newsletter, this industry newsletter. Has he
been successful in his lawsuits to try and prevent people from saying what he doesn't want them to say?
In some of them, they issued an apology or a correction or a retraction of some sort, you know, that not you know, that they didn't pay damages, and they didn't, you know, sometimes they weren't, you know, full-throated, you know, apologies. But the company claims that they're doing this to protect his reputation. It's kind of hard to protect a man's reputation when he's done what he's done and has said what he's said. I mean, he's probably the poster child, the most outspoken person on these, you know, Obama is evil, you know, he has an evil agenda, and I hope he, you know, he's killing America kind of thing. And then his actions at Crandall Canyon are just indefensible.
Hmm. You know, it seems that if you are a news organization or a media outlet that is doing the kind of criticizing that you're describing, you need a team of lawyers to be able to do that kind of.
Hopefully, not a team. Well, and as I mentioned in the column, in the age of Trump, it's a different world too, right? We're not just media was already under siege by the economics of the industry, right? We were already under that sort of threat, and now you've got, you know, the fake news thing, you know, and you know, people on the right who want to actively attack and undermine the media generally, and now you've got, you know, and then you've got people like Bob Murray, or as I mentioned in the column, Peter Thiel, who drove Gawker out of business, or you've got people like the Sheldon Adelson in Nevada, who is sort of torpedoing the Las Vegas Review-Journal. So,
casino magnate. Guys, it's a really interesting column, and Robert, one of a couple of compelling columns from this past week that you wrote. The other being a look at how cannabis has helped a friend of yours who is dying. Both of those columns and all of the stories that we discussed on the show this week are available at sltrib.com. Guys, we have like a minute and a half to do our underplayed stories of the week. Maybe I will start with managing editor David Noyce. Do you have one?
I'm not sure we underplayed this, but it's certainly a story that had a lot of buzz. I noticed on my bus the other day that there were a lot fewer people wearing white shirts. a lot of people are going to the Mormon Church office building. They changed their policy this week. Women can now wear pants, and men can wear light color shirts and take off their jackets when they're in the office. Pretty much, the bigger, more substantive change is that they approved paid maternity leave and some paid parental leave.
Okay, David Noyce's pick. How about yourself, Robert Kirky?
Dave stole mine, so I'm gonna steal one Brian Maffley was gonna use. This week, an FBI agent who was indicted for obstruction of justice for lying about shooting at LaVoy Finicum. If you remember LaVoy, he was one of the protesters at the wildlife refuge. He ended up being killed by police in a shootout. He ended up being shot by police. And this FBI agent had apparently fired shots at him and lied to investigators about it.
Okay. And Tommy Burr, your underplayed story.
I'll make it quick. If you're not following Pete Souza on Instagram, you should. He's the Obama photographer. And he's been kind of responding to Trump's crazy tweets and continued tweets by just posting these pictures of Obama, for example, meeting with women and talking about, like, this is how you show respect for women after Trump tweets about Mika Brzezinski. It's been kind of fun to watch.
All right, follow that on Instagram. You know, I think I'm going to forego mine. I'll quickly throw it out there. The fact that there's a state markup, or the state markup on wine and spirits and High Point beer is going up tomorrow, thanks to a state laws going into effect. So I guess you can save a little bit of money if you buy your wine today at the wine store. Robert Kirky, Tommy Burr, David Noyce from the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining us, you guys.
Happy 4th.
Thanks.
Happy 4th of July. That does it for this edition of the show. Thanks very much to Ross Chambliss here at KCPW for running the technical side of the show. Tom Williams, Spencer Holsey, Alyssa Roberts, and Christy Aachen manage the broadcast at Utah Public Radio. And thanks to the show's producer, Emily Means. You can find podcasts at our website, kcpw.org, or with whatever app you use to get your podcasts. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks very much for joining us, and have an excellent weekend. Happy 4th of July as well.